Radio Free Palmer, 89.5 KVRF, presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and you're listening to Mushing Radio on KVRF 89.5 FM in Palmer, Alaska, and it's covering the Mattsu Valley of Alaska. You can hear us live on RadioFreePalmer.org and on our podcast after the show at MushingRadio.com. Tonight, we're going to start our Iditarod coverage with to meet all of the mushers. We're going to try to get all 53 mushers that finished the 2012 Iditarod. And tonight we're talking to Anna Barrington. She was a rookie musher this year who is now a veteran. We're pleased to say she finished in 43rd place. Anna, how are you this evening?
Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you.
Thank you. So before we get too involved with the 2012 Iditarod and your finish this year, tell us a little bit about yourself.
I live down in Kasilof on the Kenai Peninsula. I work for Dean Osmar. I've been working for him three out of the last 5 years, and I'm still working the dogs down here, and I'll probably be on his fishing crew and stuff this summer. And I grew up in northern Wisconsin and first came up to Alaska in 2007 and didn't really want to leave.
That's pretty much it for all of us. We get up here and we get stuck, and I understand that totally. I've only been up here a couple of years myself, and, you know, I've been a musher for a long time, but here I am chasing that Iditarod dream like a lot of you guys did for many years before me. And I'm up from your area as well. I lived in Duluth for quite a while. Tell us about where you grew up there in the Northwoods there of northern Wisconsin and Minnesota there.
Yeah, where I grew up, it wasn't all farm country. There's a lot of, wooded areas and stuff like that. And there's a lot of dog mushers up there. They don't do a whole lot of long-distance stuff. It's a lot of sprint racing and things that are 200 miles or less. But my neighbor, neighbors, and they're about 5 miles away, had sled dogs. So when we were growing up, we kind of always loved animals and being outside. So it was kind of a natural fit to want to be over at her place and learning about the dogs and helping with chores. And she let us do a little junior race with three of the dogs and stuff, and so the love of it grew from there. And I think living on the Kenai Peninsula is quite comparable to the weather that it was like in northern Wisconsin, because it would get cold there, like 30 below and stuff, and we'll see that once in a while here, and the snow levels are comparable. And I grew up right on Lake Superior, so being right on the ocean just reminds me of being at the Lake Superior. So it's pretty natural fit to live down here on the peninsula. I'd like to explore more of Alaska. I don't know if I want to settle here or not, but so far it's been really good to me.
So living up in northern Wisconsin, you said there on the lake, I have a question about how you guys run there down in Kasilof on the coast. But before we get into that, what was your first experience on a dog sled? How old were you and what went on?
I was about 9 or 10 years old, and Lisa was the name of our neighbor that had the dogs. And I think she was running about an 8-dog team or something, and she had her sled on the team and then a tag sled tied to that one, and that was the first getting on the runners. And then she also took us for a little bit of a crash course with the sled tied to a snowmobile and did some sharp turns and some speed, and she made it so we would tip over, and she said, "Don't let go." So that was one kind of thing we really learned quick, was get dragged to the snow, the dogs will eventually stop. And she was really into, you know, don't lose the team kind of stuff. And so that was the first experience there, along with Christy and I, my twin sister. We had two pet dogs that we would have them try to pull a little makeshift sled that we had just down the road. Our team was a Great Pyrenees and a Border Collie and one twin sister, so we'd take turns riding the sled and helping the dogs pull and stuff, but you got to start somewhere.
You do, and you know, a lot of folks, a lot of mushers do the Border Collie thing. I think it's kind of a natural fit that a lot of us end up with a Border Collie or two, but I've never heard of a Great Pyrenees pulling some guys on a sled. How did that go for you?
Because we were little kids, it was easy for them to help, but I wouldn't recommend a Great Pyrenees throwing that into your breeding program. They're definitely equipped to handle the cold weather and stuff. When it came to pulling things, she wasn't that into it.
So as you grew up, of course, I would imagine you headed across the bridge there and watched the Bear Grease Marathon a time or two?
Yeah, we'd watch it on TV, and we kind of were more into sprint racing because that's what our neighbor did, so we'd go to a lot of sprint races with her and handle her dogs, but as we got older, we got taller and stuff, so it seemed like all the sprint racers were smaller, so it's kind of like, oh, I don't know if I can compete with these guys, so then it was kind of, well, we'll see what distance racing has to offer and that kind of thing, and both me and Chrissy thought, I mean, you spend the same amount of money feeding the dogs and the same amount of time caring for them, so you might as well be out on a sled a little bit longer than being on a 20-minute roller coaster ride. Why not be out there for 20 hours or something?
Exactly, exactly. And there's always that two sides of the fence, distance versus sprint, and it's very divided. You often see most people are in one camp or another, unless, of course, you're Jeff King and you try both. But my next question is, what brought you up to Alaska? I know your sister has been involved with Iditarod for the last couple of years, and I know you followed shortly thereafter. What made that initial leap to head up here?
Well, we work for a dog sled touring company in the Sierra Nevadas over in California, and the guy we work for was coming up to Alaska to buy dogs, and he offered one of us to go up with him to help bring the dogs back, and so Chrissy went up and met Dean Osmar, and Dean was all like, well, if you ever want a job in the wintertime, if you don't want to do touring stuff, I'll show you what it's like to run dogs in Alaska. And she came back from Alaska back to California where I was at, and she was all excited. She's like, we have to go up to Alaska next winter. I already got something lined up for us, and that's how that happened. And then I worked for Dean that year and then the year after that, and then across the street, Paul Gebhardt needed a handler, and Dean had enough, so Chrissy went next door, and that's kind of then Paul was able to offer her an Iditarod team and that kind of thing that she worked for. So that's how she kind of got into Iditarod before I did.
And what year was that you guys came up?
We both came up in October of 2007, and we both worked for Dean that first year.
And you don't get much more of an Iditarod veteran than Dean Osmar. He's been around a long time. Can you help us out and tell us some of the crucial things that he taught you guys early in your long-distance career?
Well, definitely in the first couple of four-wheeler rides training runs we did on the four-wheelers, he would always say, watch the dog's gates, learn how each dog moves because it's like a fingerprint, how they move, and memorize it. So then you'll know that when that dog isn't feeling like it always has, it'll start moving different. You'll recognize it and be able to, give it time off for an injury or something like that. So that was definitely the thing that he really ingrained into us, was to watch their gates. And he's really involved in with the training and stuff like that when we were first up here and letting us learn. And he definitely helps us learn by experience. He wouldn't hold your hand through things. He would, let you experience it firsthand, which is how I learn best, is doing, not reading or seeing. I have to do it. And helped us learn things about training puppies and about switching leaders out and that kind of thing. So, it was great to be able to learn from him.
And we're talking to Anna Barrington, Iditarod veteran now. She ran her rookie race this year, finished 43rd in this year's Iditarod. Congratulations, by the way. I know it's a tough race to do. I still haven't done it myself, but I'm looking very forward to it. And I want to get into that Iditarod in just a second. But Anna, a lot of folks are enamored by the whole mushing lifestyle. We often say that mushing is more of a lifestyle than it is a sport. And we just kind of fall into it head over heels and pretty soon we're stuck in the whole mushing, everything that is involved with our life is lifestyle. Can you tell us a little bit about what life is like at a mushing kennel down in Kasilof area?
For me, when we're in the, dog training season, you get up in the morning and you feed the dogs right away and you clean up after them. And basically you got a little time to go grab something to eat and put on your warm clothes and go out and run the dogs. And you're out running them, depending where we're at in training. You'll be doing anywhere from like 4 to 8 hour runs, or go out on a camping trip. And if you're not on the camping trip, you get back here and you put the dogs away and then you feed them again. And then you have time to go back to your cabin or wherever you're living. I live right in the dog yard. So, but then you eat dinner and kind of go to sleep, and that's the way it is. And any extra time you have, you're usually either cutting meat or packing things and all that kind of stuff. There's definitely a lot of cutting meat.
There is. And how many dogs do you guys have down there?
Dean has about 60 right now, and that's including the youngsters. And that's basically what we're doing right now is this. We're still running the adults here and there, but we're basically harness breaking the young dogs that are here that are about 7 to 10 months old.
And what happens in the summer, you know, after the season has wound down and you give the dogs a little bit of time off, what happens in the summer? You said you were interested in going out and working on the fishing boats with Dean and his crew. Is that pretty much an every-year deal for you guys down there?
Yeah, definitely for Dean, fishing is every year. That's where most of his income comes is, you know, you work hard in the summer so you can play in the winter. And, yeah, the dogs, Dean's dogs are basically on vacation, summer vacation, just like kids are from school. He does send just a handful of them up to the glacier to work. And then he has maybe like one or two litters a year of puppies. And so there's socializing puppies in your free time. But like last summer, I worked on Paul Gebhardt's construction crew, and then I did part-time on the fishing crew. And then what spare time I had was taking care of the dogs. So I definitely was running around really busy, but that's what I was able to do to earn enough to be able to not work throughout the winter because the dogs just take up all of your time. But yeah, commercial fishing is a lot of fun, and also we're able to get your personal use fish, so then we have people fish and stuff like that, and if there's any scraps we try to freeze them and feed them to the dogs later.
Michelle, you have a question for Anna?
So Anna, do you have your own dogs now down there on at the kennel, or is it just Dean's dogs?
The only dog that is mine right now is a 10-month-old puppy that I've been harness breaking. She's the only one that's really mine for now because I don't have my own property or anything like that, and I don't want to burden Dean with, hey, I've got 10 dogs, where can I put them kind of thing. But I would definitely like to get more of my own dogs. I just want to be ready for them and be able to financially feed them the way they're supposed to be fed and everything before I get in over my head.
And can you tell our listeners a little bit about that? I get that question all the time from people that don't know a lot about mushing. Can you describe exactly what goes into it in terms of cost to feed an Iditarod kennel?
Like throughout the summertime, they definitely eat a lot less because they're not working so hard, but they are always on a high-performance dry dog food, and we feed Red Paw, so that's right around about $50 to $55 a bag for a 44-pound bag of it or 40-pound bag of it. And to feed like 60 dogs, you're feeding about a bag of it a day. So that adds up really quick. And like we do buy fish from chum fish from the canneries and stuff and feed those to the dogs. But then once, you know, the height of training starts out, you have to keep feeding them the calories. So then you're buying a lot of different kinds of meat and fat. And that just, it adds up to feed that many dogs. And then there's the little things you don't think much about, like straw. It costs about $14 to $16 a bale, so you got to straw all the dog houses. And that's just the feeding kind of cost. And then on top of that, there's harnesses and sleds and lines and those kind of things.
It does add up quick. You pretty much have to have a second or third job if you're just a regular 9-to-5 guy, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about your prepping for the Iditarod. What qualifying races did you win? How did you do? When did you do those?
My very first race I did was the Klondike 300, and I was really shocked that Dean put me for my first long-distance race in a 300. But, I mean, if he said I could do it, then I thought, okay, if Dean thinks I can do it, I can do it. So I did the Klondike 300 for my first race in 2008, and then 2009 I did the Kinnick 200, and then I did, I think it was 2010, I did the Tioga 300, and then 2011, I also did the Sheep Mountain 150. I did that one twice because I did it last year, and I did the Tustamina twice, 200, I did that one twice, and then I did the Copper Basin 300. But it's right around about 2,000 miles worth of racing I did before I even started Iditarod.
So you are our first rookie that is going to be interviewed here on Mushing Radio, and a lot of talk has been throughout the years on if the racing that you guys do before the Iditarod is enough. Do you think it was running it as your rookie year?
I think what I did was enough because I did almost 2,000 miles worth of racing. And, I mean, there's no races that are far enough to compare to Iditarod, and you have to, it's going to be your first one of these days. And I just really think that people need to look in and trust themselves to know when they're ready. There can't be like this cut and dry piece of paper that says you do this, you're ready. You just know, have to know for yourself if you're ready or not, and accept the fact maybe you do need an extra year to do a few more races to get to know your dogs better, to get to know yourself better, that you can handle certain conditions. And I think that's one of the most important things, is to expose yourself to as many different situations as you can. If it's water, if it's cold, if it's wind, if it's no snow, heavy snow, just expose yourself to all kinds of things. I think that's the most important thing, and to just trust yourself and to know when you're ready, you're ready.
So March 5th or 2nd or 3rd or 4th, whatever it day, I know you know exactly what day, but the first Saturday in March when you guys were there on 4th Avenue in downtown Anchorage, were you ready?
I was nervous and stuff, and it was nice to do that run and everything just to help relax a little bit and to get the dogs out and moving and that kind of thing. But I think that Saturday night is when I felt the most nervous, because all of a sudden the steps were back in and all that kind of stuff, to where I kind of wrote off in my notes, okay, we're not doing the steps, no big deal, and then, oh, we're doing them now and stuff. So, and then asking more questions, so Paul and Chrissy, who are always around, and I started to psych myself up probably too much more, and I started wondering. But when I sat back and thought about what I did, I was like, I am ready. I don't think I could get much more ready than I am right now, and I've been working with these dogs for 3 years now, so it's like, you know the dogs, you've been exposed to all kinds of situations, so just, you know, take each day at a time and try not to think about it as a whole 1,000 miles, just think about it as each run that I was doing.
And that sounds like a pretty smart plan that you had. Did you have a very specific plan? I know we talked to some veterans. I spoke to Hugh Neff just last week on his show, and he says, you know, he's ran so many that he doesn't have a plan anymore. He just pretty much gets on the runners and rolls with it. Did you have a pretty much set plan? You're going to run from here and stop, and then you're going to rest this long, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah, I had some trail notes with me and a couple different plans. Like, oh, if the weather's nice, then go camp here. If it's not so nice, you should stop here and grab this and that kind of thing. So I had a couple different options for each kind of checkpoint or for each run. And you definitely, you know, deviate from that schedule because of what comes up. And then after a while, just all like, okay, I'm just on a run and rest schedule of running the dogs for 6 to 10 hours and then resting for like 5 to 9 hours. So that was kind of what it ended up being. And I had a team of dogs, like maybe like 6 or 7 of them had never done Iditarod or have been to Nome. So they were rookies with me. So we were experiencing everything for the first time together.
Very cool. And I know that you ended up finishing the race with your sister, and you finished right before her. How was that? When did you guys plan to say, okay, we're going to do this together and you know, run the race together and do what we do best is hang out as twins?
Well, we kind of, everybody asked, like, oh, you guys going to run together? And we didn't really know how it was going to work out. But luckily, I mean, we drew our numbers so close together, she drawing 31 and I drew 33, that we were only 4 minutes apart to start with. So then we both knew we were going to camp on the way to Squintna. So then I just knew, okay, when I see Christy, I'm going to camp too. So then when I saw her camped out, I pulled over, and from then on, we ran the rest of the race together. And there were times where her team was faster and she held them back, or my team was faster and I held them back, just because after, like, Takotna, we, you know, did our 24 together, and it was just like, to separate now would be kind of depressing. So it's like, let's just stay together the whole way, and who knows if we'll have this opportunity to do this again, so let's just enjoy it for what it is, and, you know, we'll be able to race more in the future. Let's just enjoy this trip together right now.
So I've done all of my preliminary questions. I want you to tell us what you thought about that rookie run. How was it for you? Tell us about it in your own words. What was it like on that first 1,000-mile race, you know, out there all alone, you know, doing your thing and coming under that arch there as a rookie and, you know, finally doing it? Tell us about that.
Oh, it was just beautiful. And sometimes people ask me, oh, what was your favorite part or something like that, and I just kind of get lost in thought because it just, you know, all these emotions come back and just, I just get lost thinking about it. And I was like, oh yeah, sorry, you asked me a question. But I was glad that it wasn't an easy year. I was glad that, I mean, we got offered a lot of different weather. It started out, you know, the day one was nice and sunny. And then after that, it got really snowy till Chrissy and I got just outside of McGrath, it quit snowing and stuff. And then it was nice for a couple of days. And then it got really cold when we were camping and traveling along through Cripple and Ruby and stuff. It got really cold, 40 below and stuff. And then the wind started to hit once we left Unalakleet. It got pretty windy and stayed really windy for pretty much until we got to Nome. It would be off and on windy. So I was glad that there was a lot of different aspects that were offered in the weather department. So it wasn't just a easy kind of run. And I was happy with all the stuff I had. All my gear and everything kept me warm enough, and I had great stuff for the dogs to wear so they didn't get cold. And just to see, to read and to hear about all these things, like what the gorge is like and the blowhole and the steps and the burn and those kind of things, to finally do them myself was just, it was amazing. The gorge itself, and I've heard a lot about it, but I didn't know it was that long. I kept wondering, when am I going to get to the bottom of this? And then finally, I was like, oh, we're finally to the bottom. And then just to see other mushers at the checkpoints and to see what the checkpoints look like. Someone could say, like, oh, yeah, Nikolai's great. It's like, well, I don't know what Nikolai looks like, but now I do, and it is great. And just to travel the whole thing with Chrissy, like I said, was a once-in-a-lifetime experience that will always have that memory. And that you go through a roller coaster and things and stuff, and it was great to have her there when I was, because a couple times I was like, I got to drop this dog, and I don't think he's going to make it. And Chrissy was like, well, I'll walk him around and stuff. I walked him around. She's like, he'll make it. Just take care of him, and I know you take care of him, he'll make it. And he did make it the whole way. His dog is Demon that I'm talking about, and I was glad I had him the whole way. And then just when we got outside of Nome and I heard them do the siren that we're only like a mile out, and it hit me pretty hard there that, oh, this is going to be over in like a mile. I can't believe it. And then to cross the line together, it was just amazing, all of it.
You know, that's awesome stuff there. Do you have one particular story that you can share? We have about 7 minutes left, Anna. We're talking to Anna Barrington, Iditarod veteran running her rookie Iditarod this year. One story that you can share that maybe you haven't told anybody else yet.
I don't know about any kind of really funny, interesting, great kind of story, but it was fun traveling with Chrissy because we would take turns breaking trail, or we'd take turns because her team seemed faster on the uphills and stuff, so I didn't want to drag her down, so she'd kind of go ahead on the uphills and that. And we were on our way to, I think it was Elam, and Chrissy kind of waved to me, and I waved to her, and then she waved again, and I was like, kind of like, what? Because we don't talk when we're riding the dogs, so it just distract the dogs, so we were kind of like sign languaging back and forth and stuff. And she made this gesture that she was going to set something down on the trail for me to pick up. So I was like, okay, I gave her the thumbs up, and she set something down, and I grabbed my bite, and it was with a camera, so then we started passing it back and forth and doing that. And then one of the times I passed her back a piece of candy and stuff, and it was just fun to just do that, and to be able to communicate that way without talking. It's kind of like that's what the dogs do. They communicate without talking so much, and it was fun to do that with her.
Cool stuff. Tell us about the finish. You said there you are a mile out from Nome, and you hear the siren, and you figure, wow, it's coming to an end very quickly. How was that finish there in Nome? What was going through your mind after you crossed under that arch and you thought, wow, I can't believe it. I've done this finally. You know, what's next?
Yeah, I mean, so many times. I mean, the last two times I've seen Chrissy finish, and I knew, like, I think I could feed off of her emotionally how she felt, and then now I was the one having these feelings, and just to stop and to pet each dog and to just have that little contact with them, that saying, hey, we all made it, you guys did great, and just, you know, they're giving kisses and they're eating their fish that I gave them and stuff. And just, even though there were tons of people there and people trying to talk to me and that kind of thing, just when I was down with the dogs, there wasn't anybody else there. It was just me and, like, Arctic was just constantly licking my face. It was just me and him at that time, just like saying thank you to the dogs. And there wasn't anybody else there at that time when I was just petting the dogs and just being grateful for them as athletes and that we all worked together so well and made it. And then I kind of came back to it. It's like, oh yeah.
Cool stuff. And I forgot to ask the question I meant to ask a little while ago about running there in Kasila. Can you tell our folks, especially the mushers that listen to this show, what is it like running there on the coast? Do you guys run right there on the sand next to the water? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. We did do some train in the woods and along the Coho Road and that kind of thing. But a lot, Dean definitely likes to go on the beach, and I don't blame him. It's beautiful to run on the beach. You have to watch the tides. So a couple times the water has been lapping up on the four-wheeler, and you do get a little bit wet. So you definitely have to make sure the tide is on its way out or how many feet it is coming in so you're not, so you have plenty of trail and stuff. And when I lived in California, people would ask, say, you know, what, you run dogs in California, what, do you run them on the beach? And I was like, no, we run dogs on the beach in Alaska. And they kind of laughed and they didn't get it. But it's a great, it's, the sand is really nice on their feet, and you, we can get like a over 25 mile there and back kind of run. So definitely get a lot of distance on it. And sometimes the dogs get a little bit bored. You can't run the beach every single day of fall training. You got to get them out of there. Some of the leaders get a little bit burned out on it. But, and then there's what, one thing that's really nice is there's two natural creeks that run into the ocean, so we can stop and water the dogs right there without carrying it with us if it's kind of warm out. But yeah, I really like running them on the beach.
So my last question, we have about 3 minutes left. Anna, we're talking to Anna Barrington, Iditarod musher. What is next? Now it's been a couple of weeks since you've been back home. You're kind of winding down a little bit, figuring out what's next for you guys. What are you going to do next year?
Next year, I'm hoping to run Iditarod again. I think I'll still feel a little bit like a rookie until I get to do the southern route. You know, there's five checkpoints and about, you know, a few hundred miles worth of trail I haven't seen. So I want to see that and do it. And I want to see, I want to race it a little bit more, and depending on what kind of team I get to run. But I just want to, I want to be a little bit more competitive and see, to feel what it's like for the people that are further up. And I'm not talking, I want to be top 20 or something. I would love to be that, but I mean, you got to work hard to get there. And I just want to see, I want to improve and stuff. I think everybody who runs it wants to improve each year, to get new dogs to know them that have never been there and stuff. So I'm not exactly sure. I might be running Dean's dogs again. We have to do some, you know, to talk to each other and stuff like that, because, you know, like we talked about before, it costs a lot of money to do it. And a couple other mushers I've talked to that might, I might work for, but it'd be most comfortable for me to stay here at Dean's because I know the dogs and I know the trails and that kind of thing. But I hope to run Iditarod next year, and if not, I'll do any kind of mid-distance race I can, because those are fun. I like running young dogs and stuff and experiencing new things with them. That's what I usually end up running.
Can you give the rookies that are coming up here in the 2013 Iditarod, and of course we don't know who they are yet, what is one piece of advice you can give the brand new guys that are signing up for this the first time here at the picnic in June?
Probably kind of what I went over already, is that just to expose yourself to all kinds of situations. And Lance had said, put yourself in an uncomfortable situation, not a dangerous one. So just because it's, you know, if it's really windy out and pretty cold, and well, go put your dog jackets on, make sure the males are protected, you put your good gear on and go run in it, so you know what it's like when you get into those situations and know what you have on you, you're going to be able to stay warm enough and stuff. So just, you know, put yourself out there and experience it as much as you can. I think that's pretty important.
Very good. Thank you very much, Anna. We're talking to Anna Barrington, Iditarod veteran now. That's got to be very cool to hear. You're no longer a rookie, and we want to send our congratulations to you. I do appreciate you being on our show tonight.
Oh, yeah, I'm glad you guys have a show like this for everybody to kind of stay in touch and to know that it doesn't end after Iditarod.
Very good. Well, thank you very much, and we'll definitely send over any comments or questions that we get in the coming days. We'll make sure we shoot them over to you by email, if that's okay.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Thank you very much. Anna Barrington, one of the Barrington twins, runs with her sister, Christy. We hope to have her on very soon on Mushing Radio. You can hear this anytime on mushingradio.com. Until then, we'll talk to you next time. Goodbye.